Good morning, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Data and Perspectives. As this morning, we have 10 clinical investigators. We're going to explore the application of recent data sets to current patient care. We're thrilled to be back. I think this is our 16th year working with the Florida Cancer Specialists during their retreat. And we started out, I think, in Naples with about 40 people, and it's really grown over the years. We're so thrilled to be working with them again. But first, I'd like to ask Lucio Gordon, the FCS president, to say a couple words of welcome. Lucio?
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure and honor to say hello. Thank you for the speakers. Thank you, Research to Practice, Neil Love. We go back 15, 16 years. Always the crown jewel of our retreat is to learn from you and the speakers. And so thank you for the enthusiasm and the energy that's admirable. So thank you, Neil. We are very excited today. We have had long programs yesterday, and we'll have with Research to Practice for many hours, and we continue until late tomorrow. So thank you for coming in. I know it's early. Thank you for being ready for a busy day. So Neil, thank you. Take it away.
Thanks a lot, Lucio. So before we get started, I just want to catch up with the faculty. We're going to start out talking about hormone receptor positive breast cancer. For a while, there wasn't too much going on, and now, wow, this is one of the hottest fields in all of oncology. We can spend a whole hour on this and not even probably cover everything. But I had to ask the two faculty what's coming up at San Antonio. They gave me a couple of quick previews. So Joyce, you say the NSABP is presenting a phase 3 trial. It's going to be very similar to the 522 trial with Pembro. A neoadjuvant chemo IO and triple localized triple negative, but atezolizumab.
Right. Exactly.
Any thoughts about what we think you might see?
I don't know. I'm hoping it's very similar to Pembro, but I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes we get a little surprise there when we switch the IO, but let's see what happens. And then, Seth, you were mentioning that there's a big hormone trial that's going to be presented. The EMBER-3 study, we're going to talk about SERDs this morning, but this is looking at one that's not approved, imlunestrant. But this is one of the arms of the trials combines with abemaciclib, right, a CDK. Again, any thoughts about what we might see? We're hoping, I guess, that third arm's going to be better, maybe even practice changing?
Yeah, we'll see. I think it's a very exciting time. Of course, these next generation oral antiestrogens, we have some signal now from monotherapy, but the big question is what's the right combination and who are the right patients to be using those combinations in?
And I guess, Joyce, the SERD seems to be so well tolerated, it seems like we'll be able to combine it with a lot of things. You see them maybe moving up to first line?
I do think so. You know, the first line trials are going on head to head. A number of them, giredestrant, camizestrant. You know, it may be a little bit of a tall order. The CDKs are so effective. It may be hard to tease out, but you might have a better tail on the curve potentially, but they're all, you know, 80 plus percent response, you know, clinical benefit rate. It's hard to beat that, but maybe we'll see a bigger tail, but certainly later life, I think the big opportunity is in the curative setting.
Interesting. Even SERDs in the curative setting?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of adjuvant trials going on.
Right.
Both up front.
Switching.
With Cambria 2 is up front head-to-head. Cambria 1 is a switch trial. Ember 4 is a switch trial. And you know, the AIs are, you know, obviously better than tamoxifen, but they're not that great. The enzyme is very highly polymorphic. You don't get full suppression in a lot of patients. The half-lives are short, and so it's easy for the estradiol to come back up again. I don't think it's going to be that hard to beat AIs, to be honest. I think it's really time we've had another opportunity at endocrine there.
So during this morning, we're going to have the faculty giving talks. In a second, Joyce is going to talk about hormone receptor positive disease. But I mentioned that you all have the opportunity to submit cases, but we also sent out requests for cases prior to this meeting. We got a bunch of cases from people both live and also online here. And I want to start out with a case I heard about just to kind of get warmed up. So Seth, this is from Pajmada. I think she's actually a virtual attendee. Hey to everybody out there. 75-year-old retired nurse, right breast, multifocal infiltrating ductal cancer, CT3N1 multifocal infiltrating ductal cancer with extensive DCIS, grade 2 ERPR positive 95% or more, HER2 negative, no evidence of metastatic disease. She gets neoadjuvant chemo, dose dense ACT times 4 times Taxol. First of all, you know, are we going to keep doing this? You know, and this lady had no response. She went to surgery, almost no response. Do you see us ever getting into neoadjuvant hormonal therapy or maybe using Oncotype? You know, people get so frustrated when they give these people with high ER, you know, chemotherapy. Any thoughts?
Yeah, it's a tough situation when you have that T3 disease or the N2 plus disease. You know, we feel obviously more compelled to use combination cytotoxic chemotherapy. But Neil, I think the inclination that you're leaning toward here in terms of developing better personalized molecular biomarkers to predict maybe who'll be more responsive to endocrine therapy, when we might use combination therapy with targeted agents, and even in the neoadjuvant setting, I think we can eventually get there. For example, many of us during the pandemic, when the ORs were shut down for many months, we had no choice, right? Surgery was delayed, and you know, we were having to use Oncotype in that situation on the core to help decide who was going to get neoadjuvant hormone therapy or neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So I think in this case, given that it's T3, you're a little bit stuck with current guidelines, but I do think in the future we'll develop, continue to develop better tools like Oncotype and other multi-gene signatures to decide who can forgo chemotherapy, who can get endocrine therapy alone, who needs endocrine therapy in combination, some of these newer endocrine agents as well.
So Joyce, the real question here, she's going to get post-op radiation therapy, is what kind of endocrine therapy here. She's thinking, this is a 75-year-old lady, she's thinking about ribo. She brought up the issue of possible SERD trial, but the patient doesn't want to travel. Incidentally, I'm talking about the adjuvant trials. What do you think about that trial with CAMI where they looked for ESR1 mm-hmm. and then they randomized between switching just with a biochemical switch to ESR1? Do you think we'll be heading in that direction?
I do, and that's in the first line metastatic setting, and that's Serena 6. I think that's very interesting. I think that when we find the ESR1, we're monitoring for the ESR1, patients are doing fine on their, let's say, Palbo and AI or Ribo AI, whatever they're on, and you're monitoring for the ESR1, you find it, and then they're randomized to continue same versus continue their CDK but switch over to camizestrant. I think that if the PFS is longer with switching to CAMI, even though you don't get survival because people are going to get CAMI down the road, I still think it's going to change practice because that first line is such an important quality of lifetime for patients and prolonging that PFS for as long as possible. I suspect it'll become a standard of care if it's positive, which is likely to be based on PADA-1.
So Joyce is going to review some of the much data relating to this, but specifically related to this case, Seth. This doc is thinking about using ribo. Of course, the option also would be abema. Any thoughts about, and you know, we're going to go through the data, we just kind of want to start thinking about patients as well. Any thoughts about what you would say to a patient like this in terms of CDK?
Yeah, it's nice, just as of a couple of weeks ago, we now have choices here, right, in FDA approval of ribociclib based on the NATALEE trial. I think the NATALEE trial opens up the opportunity to give ribociclib to a much broader population of patients, as there were a fairly large number of N0 patients there. The challenge is when you have a patient who meets criteria for both NATALEE and MONARCH E, what should we choose? And of course, these cross-trial comparisons are perilous. But with that being said, we have longer follow-up for the abemaciclib. We know that even after all the patients are off drug, we're still seeing those curves in terms of IDFS rates not only stay separate, but they're actually separating a little bit further. For me, one of the key questions, and I'd be interested to hear Joyce's thoughts on this as well, is as we have more follow-up from NATALEE, what do we expect those curves to do? Do we expect them to stay apart? And even when everybody's off drug, you see kind of a presumptive eradication of micrometastatic disease, or will the curves kind of come back together like Penelope B, where they came off the palbociclib, there was a little bit of benefit, and then it collapsed. So I think for a patient like this who would meet criteria for both studies, it's going to come down a little bit to side effect profile, personal preferences, baseline laboratory values, and thinking a little bit about what kind of follow-up data we have for both studies. I think they're both reasonable options.
Any thoughts, Joyce? And I was always kind of frustrated that we couldn't use abema in lower-risk patients. It kind of made so much sense, the whole concept we've always had in terms of hazard rate. But now, you know, at least we have some regulatory coverage from that. We also had a case submitted of a patient who was on adjuvant abema, was having problems with diarrhea. The doc wanted to know about switching to ribo. Any thoughts about the CDK scenario?
Yeah, I agree with Seth. I'm doing the same thing. For patients that are eligible for both, I'm going with abemaciclib. We have the longer follow-up. We have the larger delta. We have the, you know, real certainty that years now off of the drug, the curves are continuing to pull apart. The Natalie, as I'll show, is very, very encouraging. I'm feeling quite certain the curves are going to continue to pull apart, but they've only been off, you know, the 3 years of drug, and we're at the four-year landmark, so another year or two will be very reassuring. However, the other day I was talking to this woman, and say, she was a good abema, older gal. I said, hey, let's get some abema going, and let me tell you about the diarrhea. She goes, I have diarrhea every day. I'm like, okay, let's talk about the ribo. And so for you. And so we switched right over. So I think that there definitely are patients that you want to go with ribo because of GI issues that they have.
All right, well, let's let Joyce go through some of the data, and then I may interrupt you during the time, but we'll stop the timer if we do anyhow, but I'll try to hold myself back. All right,
you
Joyce.
You will, Neil. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to give an update on hormone receptor positive, and Seth is as well, but I'm going to start in the early stage setting, and I know we struggle with this in the clinic every day, as was illustrated by this older patient with, you know, T3N1, and she didn't respond at all to the preoperative chemo, is who really, really benefits from chemo. And this looks at, in the 0 to 3 node positive, we're looking at Taylor X and R responder. Four more, as Seth said, four more. CET is chemo endocrine therapy. The green ET is just endocrine therapy alone. But we have this disconnect where in the postmenopausal patients, and this is the 21 gene recurrence score numbers we're looking at there, that the only postmenopausal women where the guidelines say use chemotherapy is if they have the recurrence score above 25. But then you look at the premenopausal and you're looking at the red. It's a lot more red than in the postmenopausal. So it's anybody node positive if their recurrence score is 11 or above. And then the 21 to 25 N0 or the 16 to 20 N0 with high clinical risk as well. And also top right, the 70 gene signature, so that's the MANA print, in patients that are clinical high risk but genomically low risk, 0 to 3 nodes, randomized to chemo, no chemo. So with the postmenopausal genomically low risk, no benefit from chemotherapy. But with the premenopausal genomically low risk, you saw a 5% improvement in invasive disease-free survival. So all three of these trials, Taylor X, R-Xponder, and MINDACT, showed that the premenopausals were benefiting from chemo, even with these lower recurrence scores, and the but the postmenopausals are not. And the answer is down in the bottom right. It's because fewer than 20% of patients in all of these huge trials got an LHRH agonist because they started before we had the soft and the text. So the question, of course, is chemo playing an endocrine therapy role, causing ovarian function suppression? And we know from the most recent Oxford overview analysis that ovarian ablation on the left, ovarian suppression on the right, can have a very substantial improvement here in recurrence-free survival. So turning off the ovaries, whether it be with an LHRH agonist or whether it be with chemotherapy, would be expected to favorably impact outcome. I do want to point out here, because something else we struggle with in clinic, which is, should we take the ovaries out of these high-risk ladies, or should we just give them 5 years of LHRH agonist and then stop? And these are cross-trial comparisons. This is certainly not ovarian ablation versus ovarian suppression. But notice on the left, on the ovarian ablation, you know, that's the ovaries are gone. You know, it's looking like the recurrence-free survival curves are starting to flatten out, whereas in the control, they continue to trickle up. Whereas over on the right, ovarian suppression is 2 to 5 years in these meta-analysis trials, and we don't see any flattening of the curve there. You know, this is just something that, you know, we don't have much data, so we're just kind of looking, but that's interesting to me. I do tend to take the ovaries out of somebody that's very, very high risk. So the point here is that ovarian function suppression is highly effective in our patients, and it wasn't used in our big three trials. So at ASCO, Kevin Kalinske gave us an update on R-Xponder, and illustrated in the bottom left is the premenopausal results of 5.2% absolute improvement in invasive disease-free survival with the 1 to 3 node positive group and the recurrence score 25 or less. And what was done in this subset analysis is they looked at anti-Mullerian hormone levels. They had them stored, baseline AMH levels, and they looked at the 50 to 55-year-old group who were technically premenopausal, so they were having some menstruation, And they found that patients with the low AMH, so less than 10 picograms per ml, low AMH, so that means the ovarian reserve is done. So it's gone. They still may be menstruating, but they have no ovarian function reserve. They didn't benefit at all from chemo in our responder. But if they had medium to high levels of AMH, meaning they still had ovarian function, then they benefited from chemotherapy. Another piece of evidence that chemotherapy may really be suppressing functioning ovaries and not really doing anything when the ovaries are done. You know, I'm starting to use AMH. I came home from ASCO and I started to use AMH as another piece of the puzzle. I'm also using it, you know, does somebody need an LHRH agonist? You know, is it okay to give them an AI? So I'm starting to use it because these are questions we don't have answers to. So I thought this was a very interesting piece of information. But we really need the results of this offset trial, the NRGBR009. It's got 130 patients on it so far, I was just told the other day. And so this is for these premenopausal patients, 1 to 3 nodes, or N0 with 21 to 25, or 16 to 20 with high clinical risk. And then they're randomized to the standard of care, which is chemotherapy, OFS plus AI, versus the investigational arm, which is OFS plus AI. It's going to be 11 years before this is accrued and reads out. So in the meantime, we have to, you know, use the strategies that we talked about, a little bit of AMH, and there are other things we could discuss as well. So very, very important trial. It's really starting to pick up accrual, actually. So that's very important. So another dilemma we have in the clinic, of course, is how long to keep the endocrine therapy going for in our higher risk node negative, our node positive patients. And this slide summarizes 5 analyses done on prospective randomized trials where they went back and looked at the breast cancer index. And, you know, breast cancer index is H over I. It is a measure of endocrine therapy sensitivity. It's a measure to what extent the estrogen receptor is driving that cancer. And in all of these trials, it's kind of third up from the bottom. You can see there was like a 50% to 2/3 reduction in the risk of recurrence in the HI high. So the highly endocrine therapy sensitive group benefited from extended endocrine therapy, but in these trials, none of the HI low benefited from extended endocrine therapy because they may be high risk, but the cancer is not really dependent on the estrogen receptor. So look at this slide. This is very interesting. It's a very consistent story here among these 5 trials. So down the bottom, the ASCO guidelines say that in patients with node negative or 1 to 3 node positive, consider the breast cancer index or the CTS5 online algorithm to help decide about extended endocrine therapy. But they say 4 more nodes should get 10 years of therapy. And so also, in addition to ASCO, NCCN down the bottom, the only tool we have to look at the utility of extended endocrine therapy is the BCI per the NCCN guidelines. They do say that it is predictive of benefit from extended adjuvant endocrine therapy. And so that is a tool. We were part of the BCI registry trial. I got used to doing it in everybody, and now it's part of my equation. I'm doing it on everybody and just putting it into the consideration as we talk through it with the patients. So let me update you on MONARCH E. We got the 5-year mature data now presented by Nadia Harbeck at ESMO this year. Everyone's well aware of the MONARCH E. It's for patients with 4 more lymph nodes positive. Of course, HR positive, HER2 negative. 95% had chemotherapy. 4 more lymph nodes positive, or if 1 to 3 nodes positive, grade 3, and or T3, T4, and or centrally done, Ki-67, 20% or higher. Everybody got endocrine therapy, randomized to 2 years of abemaciclib versus not. At the 5-year mark in the intent to treat population is 7.6% absolute improvement. So these patients got 2 years of endocrine abema. Now they're at the 5-year mark. So they've been off a couple, 3 years. And in the cohort 1, which is taking out the high Ki-67s and looking at the T3, T4 and the grade 3, it's 7.9% improvement in 5-year IDFS. I've been quoting about 8% to patients, and I said the curves are continuing to pull apart, so this is good. We don't have survival yet, but in the green on the right, that's the number of patients who have recurred with metastatic disease but haven't died yet. And so we see a 50% reduction in the number of women living with metastatic disease, and it's expected this will turn into a survival improvement over time. Really terrific news that in patients who had no dose reductions in the green or one or two dose reductions in the red and the black, zero difference. In fact, if anything, those who didn't get a dose reduction are doing a little bit worse, probably because there wasn't as much adherence to the therapy. So it's really a night, it's a big, big improvement in symptoms to go down to 100. So as we're seeing these patients every 2 weeks for 2 months, we should have a low threshold for going down to 100 because we got to keep them on therapy and they feel much better on the 100 if they're struggling at the 150. So in the study, 43% had a dose reduction in Monarch E. So September 14th, we had the press release of the FDA approval now of adjuvant ribociclib. And in the top paragraph, they approved it in combination with an aromatase inhibitor for the intent to treat population of NATALEE, which I'll show you. And then secondly, they approved the ribociclib and letrozole in a co-pack for the same indication. So putting them together. So we had an update at ESMO this year as well on NATALEE with now 4-year landmark analysis data. So NATALEE, as you know, were high risk and intermediate risk patients, HR positive, HER2 negative. Anyone node positive was eligible. If they were node negative, they had to be T3 and 0, or just by itself. If they're T2 and 0, they had to have one additional high risk feature, either grade 3 or a high oncotype or mammoprint print or a high 21, a high Ki-67, 20% or higher. And nobody T1 and 0 was eligible. And so they all received a non-steroidal AI, of course, with an LHRH agonist if they were premenopausal, and it was a randomization to with or without ribociclib, 400 milligrams daily, 21 days on, 7 days off, for 3 years. The reason it's 400 is because it was a head-to-head comparison, first-line metastatic, of 600 versus 400 in the AMELEE trial. The progression-free survival curves are completely overlapping. And it's better tolerated, less neutropenia, less QTC prolongation, no difference, however, in liver function abnormality. So that's not dose-related. So the primary endpoint, invasive disease-free survival, 63%. Finished. Now, all the patients were off. Everybody's off ribo with this analysis. 63% completed the 3 years, 20% stopped because of AEs, and the others stopped either because they didn't want to take 3 years of pills or other reasons. And at the 4-year landmark analysis, there was actually a large increase in the absolute improvement in invasive disease-free survival between the 3 years, where the delta was 2.7%, up to 4.9%. So that's really quite large. That's about a 5% improvement. You can see the hazard ratio of 0.7, highly statistically significant. So no question, these curves are continuing to pull apart. And it's regardless of whether you're node negative on the left or node positive on the right, the delta is 5% in both of these groups. So both groups are really benefiting. And furthermore, they also showed at ESMO Breast that on the left, patients who got an early dose reduction from 400 to 200, or a median of about 3 months, so kind of an intermediate time point for a reduction, or on the right, a little bit later dose reduction, you can see there's no difference in those who had a dose reduction versus did not have a dose reduction in terms of IDFS. So if we have someone who has neutropenia or other toxicity with the 400, we can get down to the 200, and these data suggest that it would not make a deleterious effect on their outcome. So very well tolerated, the ribociclib. We do have to watch the liver function abnormalities. About 8% of patients had grade 3 LFT abnormalities, so we got to see the patients every 2 weeks for 2 months and check the LFTs. So then switching to metastatic disease, just a summary that shows us the survival data in the first line metastatic. The three trials on the bottom are the Mona Lisa trials with ribociclib, all first line trials, stat sig improvement in survival. And then the pink are the abemaciclib MONARCH trials. And MONARCH 2 is a significantly positive for survival. The MONARCH 3 has the same 13-month absolute improvement in survival, first-line metastatic, as the Mona Lisa 2 does. They're identical in terms of their data. But you can see that the confidence intervals on MONARCH 3's survival point estimate crosses one. It's not statistically significant, but there were 20% fewer patients in MONARCH 3 compared to MONA LISA 2. That's my interpretation, because the p-value was borderline. So I think it was just a bit underpowered. I don't know why PALOMA 2 didn't show survival, because real-world evidence, it does show survival, but nonetheless, the PALOMA 2 was negative for survival. And so, Seth, did you present this?
Kevin
presented this. A post-MONARCH, but he was very instrumental in this trial. The post-MONARCH was what do we do post-progression on first-line CDK, mostly palbo and ribo. Like 8% of patients had some abemaciclib first-line, but it was mainly palbo and ribo with an AI first-line. And so this is a pure second-line trial. No prior chemo, so right from AI CDK to a randomization to fulvestrant with or without abemaciclib and PFS, the primary endpoint. And you can see down the bottom left, it met its primary endpoint. There was a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival. It's too early yet for survival. And as I look down the forest plot on the bottom right, those curves are all overlapping. I don't see any subset that doesn't benefit. You know, my personal opinion, down the very bottom there, the point estimate for prior ribo now going over to abema is right on one, but the confidence intervals are overlapping, the palbo and the abema. So I don't make much of that, because it's small numbers and overlapping confidence intervals. So to me, it all looks very similar. So there's definitely some patients that benefit from switching from palbo-ribo to abemaciclib. And no visceral MET patients on the left do particularly well, so more endocrine therapy sensitive type patients. On the right, patients who got at least 12 months on their prior CDK, again, more endocrine therapy sensitive disease, benefited more than those who did not benefit at least from 12 months. So I think this may become an option for us. I think many of us use two regimens of CDKs. If we start with the palbo-ribo, I do, before I go on to cytotoxic therapy, unless patients, of course, are in extremis, I will give the abemaciclib before going on to cytotoxic therapy by and large. But it would be nice to have FDA approval on that. Speaking of which, we had another FDA approval October 10th for inavolisib, the oral PI3 kinase inhibitor in HR-positive, HER2-negative. And so the FDA approved inavolisib with palbociclib and fulvestrant for patients with endocrine therapy resistant disease that recurred on adjuvant endocrine therapy, or the trial is within a year of completing their adjuvant endocrine therapy. They also approved the Foundation One liquid CDX to find the patients with the PI3 kinase mutation. This was first line metastatic disease. Here's the schema. These are poor prognosis patients. They were recurring on their adjuvant endocrine therapy, or within a year of stopping their adjuvant endocrine therapy. They had a PI3 kinase mutation, either in their tumor tissue or in their blood, and they were randomized to palbociclib and fulvestrant with placebo or with inavolisib. Now, up at the top it says, inavolisib's highly potent selective PIK3CA inhibitor that also causes the degradation of mutant P110-alpha, so it leads to the degradation of PI3 kinase, which they were hoping would improve the therapeutic window, meaning more activity against the mutant than the wild type, but it does inhibit the wild type as well. And so the primary endpoint was progression-free survival, and it's 9 milligrams of inavolisib daily, but the patients had to have a hemoglobin A1C less than 6%. And this was first line metastatic. And you can see that the palbo plus the fulvestrant was indeed active in this group. That's the red CBR and ORR. But the addition of the inavolisib really doubled the CBR and the ORR. And interestingly, in the red curve here, that's the palbo plus fulvestrant in this PIK3CA, you know, kind of endocrine therapy resistant group. It's only 7.5 months median PFS, and it goes up to 7.3. It goes up to 15 months. A really large improvement in these patients whose cancers are probably very much being driven by that PI3 kinase. So this is really a very nice improvement. Now, in the top, in the middle top, we see in the blue the toxicity. So definitely hyperglycemia, and diarrhea, rash, as well as some stomatitis. So these are some toxicities we're going to need to take some prophylactic approaches to, as we do with alpelisib. This is less toxic than alpelisib, but it has some of the same toxicities as alpelisib, so we will end up using, for this very high-risk group of patients, some of our strategies to prevent rash, stomatitis, and, of course, the hyperglycemia. However, interestingly, if you look down the bottom and you look at the interruptions, in spite of the toxicities you see above, if you look at interruptions, it was 27% for the sugar, but it was low for diarrhea and the others. But then in terms of dose reduction or discontinuation, it was actually very, very low. So some interruption and then some modification of, you know, how to manage the toxicity seemed to really help most patients because there weren't that many dose reductions. So this is now available to us, but we have to know if somebody's recurring on their adjuvant endocrine therapy, we have to get the NGS and the ctDNA right away, you know, to know what to do in that first line setting. So summary, 3 years of ribociclib in high intermediate patients improves IDFS and distant relapse-free survival. The adjuvant of abemaciclib, the improvement in IDFS continues, the curves continue to pull apart, and now we're at 5 years. Second line of bema plus fulvestrant had superior PFS to fulvestrant alone after progression on first-line CDK, and it might be an option for second-line therapy after first-line progression in patients who don't have a mutation that can be targeted, you know, ESR1, PIK3CA, AKT, or P10. And then inavolisib triplet here for this endocrine therapy resistant group that's PIK3CA mutant, a very poor prognosis. This is a nice advance, I think, for that high-risk group.
So, wow. We kept adding time to our timer because they're just such good stuff. I think I've mentioned before, we actually launched, I was talking about being with FCS for 15 years, we actually launched our company with a video called The Hormonal Therapy for the 1980s, and we had these little Pac-Man figures of estrogen. If you ever remember aminoglutethamine and tamoxifen, anyhow, wow. So just a few of many potential follow-up questions. Seth, one thing we were just talking about is sort of post-CDK abema. And Joyce mentioned patients without targetable mutations there. What do you do for practical purposes? You're actually doing that? Have you seen clinically beneficial responses?
Yeah, thanks, Neil. I agree absolutely with Joyce's summary there. The data from PostMONARCH was encouraging no matter how you looked at it, whether it was interim analysis, final analysis, investigator assessed, blinded central review, it was statistically significant. But the magnitude of that clinical benefit, I think, is somewhat debatable. And I think it's a step in the right direction. Right now in clinic, if somebody has a targetable alteration in the PI3K pathway elements or an ESR1, I would probably be more enthusiastic about reaching for one of those agents, either standard of care or one of the next generation anti-estrogen trials. But for somebody who doesn't have any of those genomic alterations and you know doesn't have you know visceral crisis or sort of really urgent need for debulking, I think considering switching endocrine backbone and switching to abemaciclib would be very reasonable based on the post-MONARCH data. As a plug for San Antonio, we are sort of beginning a deep dive into the molecular genomics of post-MONARCH to start to take a look at who those patients are that might not get benefit or who those patients are that might get the most benefit. And so we really want to move to deliver upon the promise of personalized precision oncology to help make this decision easier for everybody in the clinic.
So I want to ask, I'll go back to you, Seth, also, but first I want to ask the audience here, and we're going to do some live polling here in the room. Yes or no, are you generally using breast cancer index with patients who hit 5 years of a hormonal therapy? I'm curious to see in the audience, are you actually using this in the types of patients that Joyce was talking about? And Seth?
I think there are some cultural differences in different academic centers. Some of our providers do use breast cancer index. My understanding of the data, and Joyce had a nice overview of it there, is in terms of clinical parameters, thinking about high-risk features like tumor grade, nodal status, et cetera, you're right about 80% of the time. It overlaps with the breast cancer index, but about 20% of the time, approximately, you might either be over-treating or under-treating. So I think in that context, you know, there's certainly value in it.
So we've got a very informed room. 94% of people are doing this already. I thought it was really interesting how the hazard rate lined up between the trials. Another very common question that comes up that you kind of alluded to a little bit, Joyce, but I'd like to get your clinical thoughts is a simple one, choice of first-line CDK. A lot of people flipped over to ribo with survival data. Then we started to see survival data with abema. The question mark, but Palbo is still available. How do you decide on first-line CDK?
I use them all. My main go-to is Ribo because of the three survival data. So, but if someone has very aggressive disease, primary endocrine therapy resistant disease, I feel the data are strongest for Abema in that context. So if somebody's got substantial liver disease or, you know, very, very highly proliferative, rapidly progressive disease, and they really have not done well with endocrine therapy in the curative setting, I will always go to abemaciclib in those patients, but I use Palbo. I can give you an example. I had this professional athlete, and sure, her QTC was a little long, and she said, I don't want one side effect, and she was on Palbo 3 years, you know, so I do use them all.
So a question back to you, Seth. Joyce had a really great slide Peter Schmidt put together on Oncotype. I love the way he thought it through, and one of the areas, that if you look at that slide that's particularly controversial, addressed in the trial that's being done right now, node negative premenopausal, Oncotype 16 to 20. Clinically, what do you do with those patients?
Yeah, and I think that's a really exciting trial, and this is the data we absolutely need, to the point that Joyce made about sort of underutilization of ovarian suppression in some of those more traditional trials. I think our team feels fairly comfortable for those low intermediate risk node negative premenopausal patients. The magnitude of benefit in that 16 to 20 is not particularly compelling to me. I think that the 21 to 25 gets tougher, and the really hard situation is the premenopausal sort of limited amount of nodal disease right now, because the top line kind of summary from Kevin from the original presentation of our exponders, that you really do have to continue to consider chemotherapy there until we have some of this updated data. So to answer your question directly, the sort of low intermediate range, I'm not as worried about. I think it's a little more of a discussion for the 21 to 25. And I have patients who, in a personalized way, choose both sides of that, depending on size of the tumor and other things.
And of course, one of the most common questions we got for a number of these modules, and particularly including in this situation, also at the 5-year mark, is cell-free DNA and breast cancer, Seth.
Yeah, this is a really exciting area, and this is truly the frontier of personalized therapy for early stage disease. The data here for tests like Signatera in terms of prognostic impact is really very powerful, particularly over the first, you know, year or two. The challenge, I think, right now becomes, what do you do with the test result? If it's a positive test, what's the right intervention? If it's a negative test, could we safely de-escalate some of these patients? And so patients are coming to me all the time now asking for these tests, and we have a kind of long discussion about the value prognostically, but the limited amount of insight into intervention. Once that data starts coming in a prospective way, meaning if you have a positive Signatera, do X, Y, or Z, or if you have a negative Signatera, do A, B, or C, I think it's going to be, you know, rapid uptake of use in the clinic, but we're still kind of early days there.
We certainly have seen that in colon cancer. Joyce, a couple questions before we get to relapse, the hormone receptive positive disease, a lot to talk about there. A lot of questions about premenopausal patients. Meyer wants to know about patients who stop their menses during chemotherapy. What's your protocol in terms of ovarian ablation or suppression? How do you assess it hormonally? That data you showed about ablation versus suppression was really interesting and kind of not too surprising. How do you approach these patients? There was another question of a patient who had 5 years of ovarian suppression and was still menstruating when they stopped. Do they want to continue it? Have you used more than 5 years?
Yeah, these are very good questions. There's not specific algorithms, but if I have a woman who's pre-men, you know, if she's under 50 and she's presenting with breast cancer, I don't really, the median age of menopause in the U.S. about 51, 52, but two standard deviations goes out to age 54, and there's plenty of gals that go 56 plus, okay? So I'm very, very cautious about the strength of the ovaries. So I err on the side of suppression in those patients. But I do monitor ultra-sensitive estradiol. It really has to be ultra-sensitive estradiol. So, for example, I have a couple of gals this week, and I said, okay, you're 52. You've been on the LHRH. Let's stop it. We're going to have to monitor your ultra-sensitive estradiol, you know, every couple, 3 months for a good year and make sure you're not going to. But now I'm adding the AMH because I don't want to see a high AMH, because then I'm not going to stop. the LHRH agonist. But if it comes back zero, which a lot of them do, then I'm like, okay, let's stop the LHRH and we have to monitor the ultra-sensitive estradiol, and the FSH will come down. It should go up, right? If you're postmenopausal, no estrogen, off the LHRH agonist, the FSH should be high. If it starts coming down, even though the estrogen is low, it means there's pulsatile production of estrogen from the ovaries, and the FSH is more of an area under the curve thing. So you have to watch them carefully. But you know, we have to do that because not everybody wants their ovaries out. So we do that. Now, duration of LHRH agonist. So the NCCN ASCO guidelines say that after the 5 years, I think it's ASCO, give 5 years of tamoxifen. So that's kind of like our guidelines. We all know we don't have a trial for that. We just know that 10 years of tamoxifen is better than 5 years of tamoxifen in pre- and postmenopausal women. So that's where it comes from. You know, that's why I showed you the ablation curves. For anybody with risk, I'm continuing. Or if they're finished childbearing, I suggest getting the ovaries out, you know. So that's what I do. I think that's something we are probably never going to know. We're not going to have a randomized trial on that.
This feels like a shot of Cafe Cubano here. I guess everybody should be awake at this point. Seth is my key explainer of molecular biology here, so hopefully he can put it at a level I'll figure out.
Thanks, Neil. It's a great pleasure to be with everybody. Great to be with Joyce, and great to be with you. Thank you for the invitation. I'm just going to stand so I can see the clock and stay on time here. We're going to go through a whirlwind tour today of the emerging therapeutic landscape for refractory metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer. We'll spend a couple of minutes on these next generation oral SERDs. We'll talk about the new AKT inhibitor in the clinic, capivasertib, and then we'll end with the antibody drug conjugates last. So I like to show this slide just to show you not only how much progress we've made over the last 50 years, but how much progress we've made just recently, just in the last few years. And you see in 1977, the approval of tamoxifen followed 20 years later by the aromatase inhibitors, and then we saw the CDK inhibitors, Palbo, Ribo, and Abema that we've been talking about this morning, beginning in 2015. And now, over the last few years, we've had four drug approvals, the most recent coming just a few weeks ago with inavolisib, all of which require specific molecular genomic alterations for deployment, and we'll talk about some of them today. And then for those of us who thought we could put away all of our cell cycle biochemistry back in college, it comes back to haunt us later on. So this is just a sort of broad overview of the G1 to S checkpoint. Remember, there are extracellular signals that result in upregulation of these D-type cyclins. They complex with the cyclin-dependent kinase 4 and 6. Those active cyclin CDK complexes phosphorylate the retinoblastoma RB tumor suppressor, which inactivates it and relieves E2F and drives a lot of genes that promote G1 to S transition and cell cycle synthesis, cell cycle progression. And here's a summary of lots of work in the clinic and the lab from our group and others over the last 10 years looking at molecular genomic mediators of resistance to anti-estrogen and to CDK inhibitors. And to make a long story short, we can divide these conceptually into elements that alter cell cycle progression on the left and elements that alter oncogenic growth signaling on the right. And what you see in these diagrams are the elements that provoke resistance, like cyclin E, CDK2, RB, CDK6. And in yellow, you can see potential areas for intervention with drugs that are either currently available or under active clinical development. And on the right, you see the receptor tyrosine kinases and oncogenic pathways, including RAS, AKT, et cetera. And again, in yellow, you see all these different inhibitors that are in development. We'll talk about some of them this morning. So let's start with the oral SERDs. Here's the schema for the EMERALD study. And as we start to look at some of these studies, what I encourage you to do is think about a couple of features across the different trials. Think about whether the study allowed prior chemotherapy. Think about whether the study allowed or required progression on a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Think about whether all of the patients were ESR1 mutant or only a subset were ESR1 mutant. And finally, as we learned from PostMonarch, think about whether it's investigator-assessed PFS or blinded central review. So these are the factors as we're trying to do the thing that they tell us never to do when we're fellows and compare between trials that become important when we try to read the tea leaves as to where these drugs are going to be going over the next few years. So with that in mind, EMERALD was prospective phase 3, up to one prior line of chemotherapy, one or two lines of endocrine therapy, and they must have all had progression on a CDK4/6 inhibitor. The primary endpoint here was blinded central review. Not all of the patients had ESR1, a subset did. And they were randomized to endocrine therapy of clinician's choice, either an aromatase inhibitor or fulvestrant, or the oral SERD elacestrant. And here are the curves. On the left, you see the intention to treat overall population. On the right, you see the ESR1 mutant subpopulation. Over 20% of these patients in both arms had prior chemo. Almost 50% of the patients had ESR1 alterations, and over 40% of the patients had at least two prior lines of endocrine therapy. And the intention-to-treat population had an improvement from just under 2 months to just under 3 months, but look at that steep drop-off in the curve, right? Both arms drop very steeply. Somewhere around 30-ish% of the patients are really endocrine refractory, regardless of whether they're in the control arm or in the elacestrant arm. And then you see the curves start to divide a little bit. And when you look specifically at the ESR1 mutant subpopulation on the right, there was a more prominent improvement from about 1.9 months to almost 4 months, with hazard ratio improving from 0.7 down to 0.5 and highly significant p-value. When the authors then stratified by how long the patient was on a prior CDK, 6, 12 versus 18, you see the magnitude of benefit continues to improve, such that if you had at least 18 months on your first line therapy, now we're seeing a delta from about 2 months to almost 9 months, again with a hazard ratio of under 0.5 and a significant p-value. So this is sort of how clinical practice has evolved to utilize this agent, FDA approved for ESR1 mutant, but we're really thinking about it for patients who did well on their first line of endocrine and CDK. Now, here's the SERENA-2 study. There are lots of different oral SERD studies, and you know, we could spend an hour going through all of them, but I just wanted to pick this representative one. This is a phase 2 camizestrant versus fulvestrant. Patients had to have progression on a prior line of endocrine. They didn't have to have CDK, but most of them, I think, did. They were allowed to have had up to one prior line of chemo and ESR1 wild type and mutant. They had several doses of camizestrant monotherapy versus fulvestrant. And again, here we see similar pattern. Look at the drop in the curves right up front between 20 and 30% of the patients before the curves separate. And you see in the overall population a PFS improvement at both doses of camizestrant from about 4 months to up to about 7 to 8 months. But again, when the authors divide by ESR1 mutant versus ESR1 wild type, almost all the benefit, or all of the benefit really, is confined to the ESR1 mutant subpopulation, where you see PFS improvements from about 2 months. Notice how the control arm does worse in the ESR1 mutant, up to 6+ months with the camizestrant intervention. So very similar to what we see in the EMERALD trial. And then here's a summary, and this is not an exhaustive table, but I think it's representative of some of the key studies that we either have data for or we're about to get data for in the next year or two. We have two positive SERD trials that I just showed you here, SERENA-2 and EMERALD. We have two negative SERD trials, AMIRA-3 and ACELERA. And then we have a few of these key studies. We just talked about EMBER-3 that's ongoing right now, where we're looking at imlunestrant versus endocrine therapy, and then an arm with imlunestrant abema. We have VERITAC-2, which is with the PROTAC vepdegestrant, a proteolysis-targeting chimera. And we have the ELAINE-3 study, which is with the next-generation SERM, lasofoxifene, plus abemaciclib. So these are key studies, and we'll start to see phase 3 data for doublet combinations with targeted agents, which is critical given the magnitude of clinical benefit we're seeing with the single agents that I just showed you. So just to come back to our diagram before, remember, receptor tyrosine kinases, the PI3 kinase AKT pathway is critical here. P10 blocks activity of PI3 kinase. When you have activated PI3 kinase, you see AKT activation, which drives growth, survival, division, motility, metastasis. We now have alpelisib for PI3 kinase and capivasertib for AKT, and we just saw recent data from the second PI3 kinase inhibitor in the first-line setting. Let me focus on capivasertib. This is the CAPItello 291 study. And again, here, patients had up to two prior lines of endocrine therapy. At least half of them had prior CDK inhibitors. They were allowed to have had one prior line of chemo. They had to have a hemoglobin A1C of less than 8, and they were randomized to fulvestrant alone, really in the primarily in the second line setting here, versus fulvestrant plus capivasertib, the AKT inhibitor. Primary endpoint was investigator-assessed PFS. And here are the overall curves. You again see that steep drop, but notice it's not quite as steep in the intervention arm because we're probably rescuing some of that ER resistance with the AKT inhibitor there. And then the curves separate, and we see an improvement from about 3.5 months to 7 months. Now here, when they looked at a limited amount of biomarker subset, they didn't see a signal specifically for benefit, you know, isolated to the PI3K pathway altered population. But there's data from other studies, data from translational efforts that does suggest that the PI3K pathway elements are key to driving sensitivity to these agents. And so the FDA recently approved capivasertib in the population that has alterations in PIK3CA, P10, or AKT. And then let's end in the last couple of minutes with the antibody drug conjugates. We're going to go through three studies quickly here. We have DESTINY-Breast06, which is a multicenter randomized phase 3 prospective study of trastuzumab deruxtecan in hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer. The difference between DB06 and DB04 is that here these patients are chemotherapy naive in the metastatic setting. So these are your patients that have had typically up to 2 lines of endocrine with targeted therapy, but they haven't had chemo. They're HER2 low, so IHC 1 to 2 plus, FISH negative, or this new category with DB06, HER2 ultra low, which is IHC 0 with a small amount of sort of blush staining according to the pathologist. Here we had patients randomized, over 800 patients, 1-to-1, to chemo of clinician's choice, capecitabine, nab-paclitaxel or paclitaxel versus trastuzumab deruxtecan. Primary endpoint was PFS by blinded review in the HER2 low. And here's the curve. We're used to seeing these really impressive curves for TDXD in this endocrine positive population. We see an improvement in the control arm from about 8 months to over 13 months with a hazard ratio of 0.6 and a highly significant p-value. And the data was very similar for the ultra-low population when they were included here as well. They were a smaller subset, as we just saw. And here's the overall survival data with sort of a trend toward improvement from about 82 to almost 88% in the overall in the HER2 low population, and then in the overall ITT, including the ultra low, it was similar, 81 to about 87. Remember here that somewhere around 20% of patients got TDXD later, so that obviously influences these survival curves. So clearly, there's some signal of activity, even despite the fact that many of these patients were going on to get TDXD after. And then here's the TROPICS-02 study. So this is with sacituzumab govitecan. Here, these patients were a little bit more heavily pretreated. So they had to have had endocrine therapy and a CDK inhibitor and a taxane. And here's the important thing. They had to have had at least 2, but not more than 4 prior lines of chemotherapy for metastatic disease. They were randomized 1-to-1, again, to chemo versus sacituzumab. PFS by blinded review was the primary endpoint. And then here are the curves where you see an improvement in median PFS from about 4 months to 5.5 months. And you see PFS benefits at 6 months, 9 months, and 12 months. And on the forest plot, you see that all of the different subgroups really demonstrated benefit fairly equally. And then here is the overall survival improvement from about 11 months to just over 14 months with a hazard ratio of just under 0.8 and a p-value of 0.02. And then finally, here's TROPION-Breast01, randomized phase 3 global study. So this is Dato-DXD. I think of this as the child between sacituzumab and trastuzumab deruxtecan. So it has the TROP2 antibody from sacituzumab and the same payload from TDXD. Here, this was hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, HER2 again as defined by 0 to 2 plus with FISH negative, 1-to-2 prior lines of chemo. They had to have had endocrine therapy, and they were randomized between chemo of clinician's choice or Dato-DXD with an endpoint of PFS by blinded review. And here are the curves, fairly similar to what we just saw, about 4.5 to 7 months with a hazard ratio of 0.64. And you can see, again, at 6, 9, and 12 months, similar shift between the curves. The toxicity here was very manageable. Fatigue, some infusion-related reactions, ILD were rare. There were discontinuations of 1% each for all of those. There was one treatment-related death, but it was in the control arm for febrile neutropenia. And so just to summarize and end, this is sort of putting Joyce's talk together and my talk together, thinking about where are we right now for metastatic disease. Let's imagine a patient with de novo metastatic, ER-positive, HER2-negative bone disease. So first-line therapy, most of us are going to use an aromatase inhibitor with ovarian suppression and typically ribociclib, although we just heard a little bit about why we might use one or the others. In a high-risk patient who's having sort of refractory progression on adjuvant antiestrogen, now we have this option of inavolisib, and then we're doing sequencing at baseline and typically at progression. And in the second-line setting, look how complicated it's getting here. It used to be fulvestrant monotherapy. We could think about adding abema per postMONARCH. We have alpelisib for PIK3CA mutant. We have capivasertib for PIK3CA, AKT, or P10 mutant. We have elacestrant for ESR1 mutant. We have olaparib for BRCA mutant. And then in the third line setting, could you go back to some of those other second line agents if people have multiple genomic alterations? I think that's a fair question. We have our antibody drug conjugates in the third line setting and beyond, including TDXD and sacituzumab. We have many chemotherapy options. And of course, we have lots of exciting clinical trials, next generation antiestrogens, next generation PI3 kinase pathway RAS inhibitors, next generation CDK4, CDK2, new ADCs, and many others, including immune therapy, et cetera.
Thanks, Seth. And we have tons of questions here. Before I put one out to Joyce, a question about tolerability of SERDs. Seth, they all seem well tolerated. Any way to differentiate them in terms of side effect profiles, Seth?
So I'll start, and then I think they're all very well tolerated. There are some kind of maybe idiosyncratic side effects. So, for example, I think with camizestrant, we saw a little bit of bradycardia and photopsia. In my experience in clinic, even anecdotally with some of these studies in the adjuvant and metastatic setting, they're extremely well tolerated. They may even be better tolerated than some of the aromatase inhibitors, as Joyce was talking about.
So Joyce, maybe the most common question we get in this whole area, and actually we have three, we had the three posters accepted for San Antonio, and Joyce has helped us with that. And one was a survey we did not only of investigators, but also of elite general medical oncologists. These were docs who had presented cases at our webinars, et cetera. And one was basically how they manage second-line hormonal therapy. And one of the most interesting things and interesting questions, and Brian, who's here in the room, Brian Berry, wants to know about patients who have both ESR1 and PIK3.
Right, that's such a comment. The subset analysis that was done of the EMERALD trial showed that regardless of PIK3CA mutation status, wild type versus not, that the elacestrant was superior to the standard chemotherapy, which was mainly fulvestrant. There was a small subset that had AI. Now, it was more impressive in the wild type than it was in the PIK3CA mutant, but you could go either way. So it comes down to clinical characteristics of the patient. If they got indolent disease, bone only, very endocrine therapy sensitive, by all means. If they got the co-mutations, go with the elacestrant. But if they've got more aggressive disease, a little bit more endocrine therapy resistant, then I would go after the PIK3CA.
It was interesting, too. We reported there that we showed these oncologists these micro-learning videos of 2 minutes or less, and we found that I think a third of their decisions changed within a couple of minutes. So just hearing somebody discuss it and trying to clarify it. Back to you, Seth. Same question in terms of a little bit more about how you sort of dissect out what you do when they're doubly mutated. And also, can you just elaborate a little bit more on the issue on how long they were on CDK in terms of determining whether you even use hormonal therapy as opposed to going to chemo?
Yeah, thanks. Let me take the second part of that question first. We really need to do a better job of understanding who those people are that fall right off the curve, because once we can identify those folks in a more quantitative way, we'll have a sense of who really needs to go to an ADC probably, right? Who's completely endocrine refractory. What they were demonstrated was that the longer the patient was on the frontline CDK and AI regimen, the better the elacestrant seemed to do. And we have some data that we presented at ASCO, and we'll have an update at San Antonio in the real world setting from almost 1,000 patients in the Guardant Clinical Genomic Database, how folks are actually using elacestrant in clinical practice with estimated real-world time on drug of 6+ months, which looked pretty good compared to the outcomes on the EMERALD trial. So I think right now the best we have, Neil, is using that clinical gestalt of who was on, who seems to have endocrine-sensitive disease, who was on for a long time. But we need to get better at deploying some of these molecular genomic biomarkers in a way that that takes some of that uncertainty out of it. Because even on those curves, you still see a drop. You still see a fairly significant double-digit fall. And then to come back to the first part of your question, I agree with everything, of course, that Joyce said. And I think we're in sort of limbo right now. It's a bit of a funny time where you have elacestrant monotherapy approved and you have these doublet agents. Where we're going to go very soon, though, is doublet agents with a next-generation antiestrogen and a PI3K pathway or AKT inhibitor. And that solves this problem, right? Because now you're choosing to hit both of those things kind of optimally. I think right now it comes down to the factors that Joyce was mentioning. How sick are they? What is the cadence of their disease? What's the toxicity profile, et cetera? And I think you can have scenarios where either one would be a very reasonable choice.
Yeah, you know, we talked about your study there, the real world. Of course, the Florida Cancer Specialists have done a lot and doing a lot of real world data. And this triple negative program we're doing with them, we decided to focus on time on therapy based on what you did there with hormonal therapy, although we're actually looking at this in triple negative disease. Joyce, so you're talking about HER2 ultra low, 0 to 10%. Do you have any patients who you will not use? You know, you call HER2 zero, you're not using TDXD. Also, questions in terms of the use of sacituzumab, management of tolerability issues, diarrhea, cytopenias.
So if I have a zero right now, because you know they're not really reading out HER2 ultra low. Sometimes they'll say HER2 0 to 1+. And I think that probably means ultra low. So I will use the TDXD. But if it's a true zero today, I will prioritize sacituzumab, a true zero. However, I'm a believer in reverse phase protein array. And there's a company, used to be called Theralink, now it's Ignite Proteomics. And I'll send the tissue for highly quantitative HER2 and phospho-HER2 because it'll almost always come back positive. And so then I can use later on, and somebody who's already had SASE, I can give them TDXD. So I'm still prioritizing SASE for the zeros.
And can you talk a little bit about your use of SASE, prevention and management of tolerability issues, diarrhea, neutropenias?
Yes, I think the most important thing I've learned over the years is who to start at 7.5. If somebody's very young, you know, excellent end organ function, very, very nice performance status, you know, really robust marrow, et cetera, she gets 10. But if she's more heavily pretreated, anything, I'm going to start at 7.5 on patients because it's well tolerated and people really do well not missing day 8. And I don't tend to use prophylactic filgrastim, you know, day 8. I don't tend to do that. I start the 7.5 and then, you know, but if somebody's really very, very healthy, I'll use the 10. So I think that's the most important thing. If I do that, Neil, I don't have problems with it, actually.
Really interesting. So a final question back to you, Seth. And incidentally, we had a case submitted of a patient who progressed on CDK in 3 months. Have you seen that?
Yeah, we would describe that as intrinsic resistance, upfront resistance. It's not particularly common, especially in a setting where the patient hasn't had a lot of prior endocrine therapy, but you can imagine if you look at genomics on patients like that, you see things like RB alterations, RAS, you know, pathway activity, et cetera. We would describe 6 months or less as upfront intrinsic versus more than 6 months as acquired.
So the question I want to ask you is, we used to joke around a few years ago, being an oncologist, you wake up in the morning, you check and see what's approved, and you start thinking about, so now we've got inavolisib all of a sudden. Have you used it? The numbers look like it's a lot better tolerated than, for example, alpelisib.
Yeah.
But give us a little more feel for that.
Yes, we are starting to use it. It's really exciting because it's a relatively small population, but a difficult to treat population, as Joyce was alluding to. These are the patients who are on adjuvant endocrine therapy and are progressing, you know, actively through their endocrine therapy. So this was really an important unmet need, and I think it opens up a window for these triplet regimens moving forward. And when you look at the tolerability, it does seem to be, as you mentioned, Neil, very well tolerated. Sometimes I wonder, as we get more and more of these drugs in clinic, we know what to look for. We know that we're going to get GI stuff. We know we're going to get hyperglycemia. Are we becoming kind of better at managing it in the same way that we dealt with the pneumonitis with TDXD? If you look at the rates of sort of high-grade pneumonitis now, it's lower. So I think in part some of these drugs are better tolerated. I think in part we as clinicians and the entire community are getting better at anticipating side effects and catching them when they're lower grade and addressing them.
Okay, really final question. Joyce, tolerability, CAPI, and also adherence to the CAPI schedule.
Cappy's well tolerated. You know, that the 3 days off makes a big difference in terms of the diarrhea basically abates. Cappy's interesting. You know, AKT, we haven't had a way to target it. We haven't had a way to target cancers that have lost P10. These are bad cancers. And I've seen some very robust responses in people that have cancer everywhere. And it's well tolerated. People feel, I've had durable, a couple of patients coming, very durable responses. It's quite an active agent.
Interesting. All right, we're going to move on and talk a little bit about prostate cancer. Thank you so much. Thank you.